Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined on the podcast by Mr. Martin van Staden. Martin, how are you doing?
Hey, it's good to be back.
And we are also joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you?
Afternoon, Nick and Martin. Doing well, thanks. Happy to be with you guys to try and unpack another interesting day in South African politics and news.
Indeed, indeed. Chris has informed me that he has load shedding at 2, so if he disappears at the end of our show, we shall have to deal with it. Such is the price of living in South Africa sometimes. Anyway, there's a little bit of admin to get through at the beginning of this episode, so please bear with me. The first thing to know is that we are sponsored once again today by Bitwise. And here's a word from them. Bitwise says, "We all know that Bitcoin is the best performing asset of the past decade, and many people are accumulating Bitcoin as a strategy to hedge themselves against fiat currency debasement and government overreach. The guys at Bitwise have delivered their latest product, SatStacker, to help you accumulate Bitcoin over the long term. SatStacker allows you to set up a recurring purchase order directly from your bank account, then accumulates Bitcoin for you at a frequency and an amount that you choose, depositing the Bitcoin directly into your own self-custody wallet. There are many use cases for SatStacker, from simply automating a weekly purchase of some Bitcoin for your own personal stack, to setting up a long-term investment fund for your kids. Accumulating Bitcoin in automated regular amounts has never been simpler, safer, or more convenient. Try it today. Try SatStacker today." And we thank them very much for sponsoring us. There will be links to that product in the description of this show. The other thing I just want to mention once again is that this week the IRR is coming to KZN. We're going to be near Howick on the 16th of November at 6 o'clock at the Tap Room at Midlands Fable at 85 Curry's Post Road. We know there's already going to be a couple of people from the area who have expressed interest to come. Apologies for the hammering. They've got some stuff being installed at the house now. We're also going to be in Mhlanga on the 17th of November at 6 o'clock at Garden Court Mhlanga at the corner of Aurora and Centenary Boulevard. Mhlanga in the meeting room, floors 1 and 2. The directions, these stats here will be in the comments section of the YouTube version of this video. So those listening on audio only, you can go check that out there again. But anyway, let us get into the news of today. And it looks like government is once again getting back into the fight over whether it can tell doctors where they can work and live. So as part of the NHI, one of the things that government has believes that it needs to do to reform our health system, to make it more equitable and just, is to tell healthcare workers where they can set up their practices, where they can work and where they can live. There was this provision put forward by government that it was going to ask doctors to have a certificate of need if they wanted to open a practice in an area. So in other words, if there was an area, let's say a slightly better off area, which already had a doctor, the government could then say, well, you don't need a doctor in this area, and therefore we're not going to allow you to set up your practice. You're going to have to go to an area that doesn't have a doctor already as per our determination. This, of course, would be very restrictive and would effectively place all doctors in the country kind of semi under government control, almost like being semi wards of the state. This was challenged, I think, by Solidarity in court, and strangely enough, the minister didn't respond to the court challenge. So the court said, well, I guess this is invalid and shouldn't be taken forward. It's now going to the Constitutional Court. But while it's being fought in the Constitutional Court, I think arguments are still being prepared by both sides there. The Health Ministry has come back and said to the court, no, no, we didn't get proper notice. That's why we didn't respond. And so you had to scrap that judgment because it wasn't fair on us. We weren't properly served with legal papers regarding this case, and that Solidarity didn't properly speak to us. They said that, among various things, that email was not an appropriate way to get court papers and that not enough attempt was made to contact them. Solidarity insists that they got read receipts and various other forms of non-communication from the health department. But Martin, let me start with you. Firstly, the policy, and secondly, the court case itself. In terms of policy, I don't think it would terribly shock anyone to say that we don't think that this is a great idea. Can you explain maybe why?
I read quite a while back that during the apartheid era, if you wanted to open a liquor store, you also had to get some kind of permission from the government, because if there's already a liquor store in the area, then you can't open one. So obviously, this is the same type of monopolistic thinking. And for a government with its own competition commission and its competition tribunal that talks a lot about fair competition and about encouraging competition, this is obviously not the way to do that. If you want to drive down healthcare prices, you should hope that every street has at least 40 doctor's offices standing right next to each other, because that's the best way you're going to get cheaper healthcare. So this really is nonsense. It's been on the books for years now. The National Health Act was enacted in 2003, I think. But the Certificate of Need thing was never brought into operation. And one wonders why, because I think people in government appreciate the fact that the Certificate of Need will be very damaging to healthcare. But we know that given the close historical relationship between the ANC and Cuba, that Cuba is the example that our government wants to follow. And Cuba obviously has a world-renowned nationalized healthcare sector where doctors get paid very basic government salaries and are basically part of the middle and lower classes, and they're effectively, as someone said in the comments, property of the state. So given the centralization sentiment in government, it's no surprise that they're thinking in that direction. And it's good that the healthcare profession is standing entirely against this NHI plan, because it really would be terrible for everyone, especially the poor who are trying their damnest to get out of dependency, out of the state healthcare sector. Successive South African surveys, I think, have shown, by Stats.SA, have shown that people would prefer to have private healthcare if they could afford it. The government wants to take that possibility entirely away, so that's horrifying. And then on the process, I mean, when you litigate against the state, there's this nice phenomenon where for private parties, there's a deadline. The court says you have to submit your papers by X date, and if you don't, you're out. The court says that to the state, but sometimes it takes them months past the deadline to submit, and then they have to apply for condemnation, and the court usually gives it. Now, this case is a refreshing change of pace. I'm surprised that the court didn't say, no, we'll wait for the department until it finds time to meet us in court. So I take my, figuratively, of course, I take my hat off to that judge. It's the right decision when the government shows contempt for the judicial process, as it did. It should have a default judgment granted against it. Solidarity did not only send emails, they also went to the health department, I think twice, and tried to have the papers physically signed. But apparently in that massive health bureaucracy, not one person from the legal department would answer their phones to come down to the reception to sign for the papers. So Solidarity did try that. And they also contacted a separate state department, the state attorney, which also seemingly ignored them. So I think the Solidarity went above and beyond what was reasonably required of them. So all in all, I think a good move, and I hope the Constitutional Court, when it considers this application for rescission, actually just tells the health department, listen, you've shown contempt for this process. No, the judgment stands. If you want to challenge it, you have to appeal it to the next court.
The judge who ruled on this original case in the High Court said in her ruling, George Tembi Pukako, that the respondents had, quote, without a shadow of a doubt, been aware of the proceedings, yet refused to participate in the matter, which is, I think, quite damning. But Chris, you know, there's another aspect apart from just the sort of silly economic theory, I think, behind the Certificate of Need stuff, which is that if you are so restrictive on doctors, if you say to them, well, no, you can't earn what you want, you can't live where you want, you can't work what you want, in fact, you have to do what we say. And there's already a little bit of this, right? I think all new doctors have to do what they call their Zuma years, which is, I think, 2 years or so in the public service as doctors. Then, well, we're just going to go somewhere else. There's a lot of other countries around the world who are desperately in need of doctors. There's a lot of other countries where you can get into as a doctor. we'll go there. Much better than sticking around here where we get told where we have to do work and live. Brain drain, I think, is another very serious concern when it comes to this kind of thing. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Just the basics of incentives or disincentives. So if, for example, you've got more barriers to make it more difficult for someone to engage in their profession, to even study for that profession in the first place, why be surprised if they don't undertake the risk to pursue that in the first place? And then why be surprised if they go elsewhere or simply pursue a different job altogether? I also think, I mean, it's maybe ironic or not so much that it's called a certificate of need, that idea of from each according to his ability to each according to his need. So the idea that the states and the bureaucrats are best set to decide where you should work, maybe if you're in the healthcare profession, for example, because you've aimed so high, you need to be brought back down because someone else has a higher need for your services, then maybe where you decide you think you should work best. I think it's illustrative of the broader NHI process, so I think it makes sense in that context of wanting ultimate control, for example, an NHI board or a minister to have the power to decide these sorts of things. And then when we see something like state capture 2.0 in the future, we shouldn't be surprised because you incentivize that abuse in the hands of one person or maybe five people on a board, for example, to have this power to decide who works where and for what wages, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully if this is relitigated, then again thrown out at some point and again putting a smaller stop to the NHI in different ways. It's maybe a better way to fight against something like this is through these small cuts, 1,000 small cuts, to make sure that none of the little pieces that are needed to prop it up actually function eventually. That might be one of the best ways to ensure that we don't get the NHI in the long run.
Martin, any final thoughts before we move on?
No, I think that just as a general rule, centralization is the wrong answer. The answer should be putting more power in the hands of the individual, the family, the household. So if you want the government to play a positive role, at least in a transitional period in a poor country like South Africa, replace plans for NHI with something like a healthcare voucher, where government gives low-income households a healthcare-connected call it a grant, and says you can spend this on your healthcare at private, public, whatever facilities you wish. We won't tell you where, we won't tell you when, we won't tell you how. It's your choice, and use it well. And that's the way that you encourage competition, you encourage freedom of choice, and you also encourage a sense of personal and family responsibility. So if government does want a role to play, I think ideally it should play no role because everything it touches dies. But if it wants to play a positive role, it should be through healthcare vouchers rather than more centralization.
Right, and if government doesn't want to go that route, they can at the very least do some proper looking into why people like Vijay Deokrane are getting murdered for blowing the whistle on health, on hospital corruption, rather than trying to crush the private sector. That, I think, would probably do more good. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic, and I believe the G20 summit is underway in, I think it's Indonesia, that's being hosted this time. Anyway, every country that participates in the G20 is rated on a number of targets that it's supposed to meet, that it agreed to meet at the last G20 summit. But as with a lot of these things, World Economic Forum G20, there's an awful lot of talk shops and parading in front of cameras and diplomats hanging out with each other and drinking at bars later. But I don't think actually much sensible is said. Regardless, the report has come out on how each country did with regards to its compliance with the G20 commitments, and of all of the countries involved with the G20, South Africa has scored the worst, achieving only 50% on our commitment score. But when you actually look into the report, some of it is very odd, and it really makes you question what exactly some of these things are supposed to be measuring. So the highest country that achieved the highest was the UK with 95%, the European Union at 90%, Turkey with 60%, and South Africa down at 50%. South Africa was deemed to have scored high on, and this one makes no sense, fair and inclusive in providing access to new forms of work, quote, leaving no one behind. I'm not sure what specific new forms of work they're referring to in this report here, but I find it difficult to characterize the South African economy in any way as something that doesn't leave anyone behind, considering our massive unemployment rate. We also apparently got great marks for our plan to counter climate change. However, we did poorly on such things as trustworthy human-centered AI development, which is great. You can see how that came out of the committee, that phrase, as well as our crime and corruption commitment, which requires countries to take, as it calls, adequate measures to curb money laundering, including by improving transparency about who actually owns assets. These measures were supposed to be in line with the Financial Action Task Force recommendations. This is when we're kind of on the verge of grey listing, so I'm sure it's related to that. And we also got low marks for not contributing more money to fighting climate change, even as we're receiving money to fight climate change. So I'm not really sure what that's about. So, I mean, I wouldn't take the score on the G22 seriously because it seems all a bit higgledy-piggledy. But, Chris, what do you make of it? What do you make of some of the things in this and our place in the G20?
I think you've accurately surmised the key takeaways, and mostly the focus on hot air and wanting to say that we're solving problems and we're serious about solving issues on the ground, about caring for our people, et cetera, et cetera. But it's an opportunity for governments and politicians and bureaucrats more to feel like celebrities and have this platform and say, look at us, we're solving things, you know, we're serious about engaging with each other, giving each other these scorecards and holding each other to account, but not actually doing the work on the ground. It's, for example, like having a presidential summit and talking about the fourth industrial revolution and smart cities where your railways don't even work in the first place. So that's sort of...
The Northwest government is giving people donkey carts that don't work.
Precisely. I mean, take your pick, like on a weekly basis in South Africa.
That's not even the first industrial revolution, never mind fourth.
No, exactly. So are you concerned about getting that good scorecard and that, you know, this thing about maybe scoring well on tackling climate change versus implementing incentives and reforms that will actually encourage renewable tech innovation and make it easier to move forward in that sphere or not? Where is your focus kind of thing? So I think it very much talks to the idea of smoke screens that governments like to hide behind, that they like to use, but not in terms of actual improvement in people's quality of life. I think much better to look like something like the Economic Freedom of the World report and see where a country ranks there in terms of the downstream effects of the policies that you implement on people's lives in terms of concrete absolutes in terms of what they experience. I think it's useful every now and then for them to use, but I don't put much stock by it.
Martin, what's your take on all of this stuff?
I think that sometimes when South Africa comes last, we should be very happy about that. And I think this is probably one of those cases where I'm maybe a little bit proud of being a South African who has an incompetent state that cannot implement some of the worst ideas that we get fed from the West. And one of the metrics, if I understand it correctly, is something like it has to do with standardizing effectively tax regimes all around the world. There's this big push with international organizations to eliminate tax havens. That's also part of the gray listing thing. Countries that don't keep clear records, let's say, of everyone who does business there as part of an incentive for people to invest there so that they wouldn't be overtaxed like many other countries do. So these international organizations really are trying to beat tax havens into submission, and to an extent they're succeeding. So I'm glad that on a list like this, South Africa got, I believe, a zero there as well with standardizing the tax regime around the world. But it's a mixed bag. One of the items concerns trade, and the G20 wants countries to liberalize the trade barriers, so it's lower tariffs or no tariffs, allow goods to pass freely across borders. I think that's something that's good and that South Africa should certainly do. Protectionism is always ultimately bad for the consumer. But I think those good aspects in a report like this are few and far between. The climate plan thing is actually very insulting. If I were the people who compile this report, I would have said, my goodness, just don't touch that, because the South Africans, those poor South Africans, have been suffering through an energy shortage, especially this past year. So let's not rub salt into their wounds and ask them to try to rely on wind and solar power alone, because not only did they commend us for having a good climate change plan, green transition and whatever, but they also subtracted a mark from us because we're still relying on coal power. How dare they? We need to rely on considerably more coal power and probably a lot more nuclear power as well if we're ever going to keep our lights on. So there's very much as you both said, it's a talk show, but it's very much a kind of academic, because these conferences are held in these relatively prosperous places where problems like load shedding and so on are very far from the agenda. It's very much an academic, removed from a reality discussion. And I'm very much in favor of called globalization, having cooperation across borders, and I think that's very good in principle. But when, as we've done in South Africa and around the world, especially in the last, let's call it 50 years, when you lose sight of liberty and freedom as the, call it the organizing principle of politics, when that disappears and politics becomes a general, how will we best govern society, then these things become very dangerous, because then the global level becomes very far removed from the liberty of the individual. So I think the meta point here is that these international conventions and agreements are going to be detrimental unless the world rediscovers freedom, as in many ways it used to be. The central question of why we have politics, why this thing called politics exists, and it should be to secure to the individual the maximum autonomy to provide for themselves and to have a fulfilling communal and family life. Without that, we're going to run into trouble with agreements like this. And again, as I said at the beginning, if we fail on these scores, then it's not necessarily a bad thing.
From a purely cynical point of view, I can say that if I was a delegate, I would be very happy to sit through a number of workshops on what do they call a trustworthy human-centered AI, if it meant that I then got to hang out in Bali for a few days. I've been there a few times to Indonesia, and it is a wonderful place, and I put up with a lot to be able to go and have a, I guess, taxpayer-funded holiday there for a short time. Chris, any final thoughts before we close up?
Just that the only good thing maybe to come out of this latest summit, to try and give a little bit of the other line, is the relatively positive meeting between Biden and Xi Jinping, which at this point in time, given Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, the freezing of many diplomatic relations between the two countries, there was the risk that the communication would completely break down. So at least they've been in the room together now. I'm not saying that's going to solve all the tensions going forward. I highly doubt that, but there's at least an element now of them getting into the same room together. And for me, trying to find a little silver lining here or there. So don't worry.
Don't you remember
globalists,
that Biden
and globalists Putin, are still working together.
Don't you remember that Biden and Putin had a in-depth one-to-one meeting that went on for quite a while? And then Putin went very
Ukraine. Thanks for that. Okay. All right. So, there we go. Game over.
Anyway, okay, let's move on to our last story today. And this is concerns about the privatization of SAA. So SAA is supposed to have been part of this privatization deal where 51% of the company was going to be sold to this group called the Tokatsu Consortium, which I think is consists of other smaller groups, other smaller airlines and things. So it was supposed to be sort of semi-privatized, and going forward, this would revitalize SAA and bring it back into the public. Well, it looks like there's trouble afoot with the deal. Not all of the details are clear yet, but one of a CEO of one of the groups in the, of the consortium and a board member, Gideon Novick, has apparently resigned from the company, saying that he was very concerned about the lack of information and transparency from the consortium's largest shareholder about the terms and conditions around the purchase of SAA. This is 18 months after the deal has apparently been signed. So currently, Pravin Gordhan is in Parliament swatting away some of these concerns. But, you know, I can't believe that this story is still with us. SAA is like a zombified corpse that keeps sort of shambling onwards. And this deal just continues to get more mysterious and more strange. Martin, what do you make of the story?
Yeah, if it was only a harmless zombie, but I read, I think the day before yesterday, an SAA plane at OR Tambo took off the tail end of a Fly Saf Air plane with its wing, the leading edge of its wing. So it's not harmless. it's harming. And it's certainly harmful to the taxpayer. A few years ago, SAA was receiving annual bailouts to the tune of billions. I'm not sure if that's still happening. I hope, and I think government might have learned a lesson that the public in general is kind of over.
Well, the idea here is that the consortium would pick up some of the tabs,
yes,
as far as we understand, right?
Yes, and that's how it should be. If your state company is not profitable, you should absolutely privatize. But there is also the very underrated third answer to this that no one's really talking about, and that is to close it down and liquidate it. My goodness, if you can't even properly privatize it, then you need to close it down. You need to strip it of its assets, give it to its no doubt many creditors who are waiting for payment, and close it down. We don't need South African Airways. I know the government released a paper a few years ago trying to list all the reasons why South Africa needs a national airline, and one of the reasons was in the event of war, SAA would be able to ferry troops to the front line. And I couldn't believe I was reading this, like, this statement that was, like, given unironically. And another reason, of course, is it carries the flag, and when it's like an ambassador to the outside world, and when people see SAA. And then the other reason is it sets an example to the private sector for how to properly run an airline. So those are three of the greatest reasons that I've ever seen for why SAA should be kept. But obviously that's a bunch of nonsense. I don't even think SAA owns its own airplanes currently. I think they're all leased. So I'm not sure during a time of war, unless the government nationalizes the planes it's leasing, certainly digging a hole further for the airline, that it would get far with that silly argument. So no, I think that it's right that SAA is being privatized, even if it's a corrupt privatization. I should add, I would be okay with that, because if it's out of state hands, then the corrupt parties will drive it into the ground, and it will need to be liquidated anyway, or they'll sell it on to someone else. So a corrupt privatization is better than no privatization, but don't discount liquidation. If you can't get the privatization right, do not renationalize it. Do not try to have government run it again. It can't. It's going to cost us billions again. If that can't work, then liquidate it, close it down. It's had a nice long run. No one said, the Bible certainly didn't say that SAA must always exist. It's not writ that must happen. So let's get rid of it if we can't privatize it.
Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think indicative of the sphere, one sphere that government operates in versus the lived experience on the ground and the lived realities of trying to run an airline. So this thing about, like, oh, it's the national flag carrier, all this stuff, as though pronouncements from politicians and bureaucrats should override economic reality. I don't think we should be surprised by the sort of thing still playing out. We're going to see continued mudslinging. I don't think Takatsu Consortium and their representatives would have gone into this with naivety. I mean, you know, we're going into the sort of operation with government, you're going to know you're going to have to give up certain concessions, and also at some point certain T's and C's might come back to bite you. So best of luck to them, but I'm sure that they knew what they were getting into. And for the time being, I guess when you see an SAA plane, you know, feel some pride because the flag is there.
I guess that you kind of have to use SAA to transport troops around the country because the railway system doesn't work properly. So it's not like you can send soldiers by rail from Cape Town to our northern border should Zimbabwe decide to annex Limpopo.
But we're going to get that national shipping company, so actually we're okay.
Yeah, as long as we have to move by sea, then we'll be fine. But if there's any inland nonsense, you know, like where all of our borders are, then we're going to have a big problem. Anyway, SAA. You know, the day that I no longer have to talk about SAA on this podcast is the day that we know that South Africa's turned a corner. But unfortunately, that day is not yet here. Anyway. That's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. Please remember to, if you're in KZN, to check us out at those places near Hawick and Umhlanga. And we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. I hope you have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.